You know, 100 wins has become a very common thing recently. And I know part of it is because we're up to a 162-game season. But since 2015, we have not gone a year without a 100-game winner in, obviously, a full season.
Now, look at the 100-game losers. What's happening is franchises are bottoming out, and it's happening in European soccer. Baseball is all the financials are being pushed to the top. And it's not just financials, because being a big market, mid-market, small market team.
We got to start recording.
I'm recording right now.
Oh, okay.
Hello, welcome to On the Shore. Let's just start right here.
Yeah, this is a great place to start.
There's big market. See, what normally happens is we just click record and then I do a whole On the Shore thing. Yeah, whatever. We're not doing it today.
And then I understand that we've begun the show, but today I don't understand that we've begun the show.
But now we actually have
begun the show. But now I understand that the show has begun.
Now the timer's on.
There's a whole thing. There's concepts, there's understanding.
So people think of big market, mid market, small market teams as, okay, that's what they spend on players. But it's not just what they spend on players, because to win in Major League Baseball, it's much more similar to European soccer than the other American sports are. The fact that you have to develop your own players, and that if you don't develop your own players, sure, you will fail every time. You will be unable to succeed at the highest levels. Now, for a short minute in baseball history, that benefited small market teams, because the Yankees and the Dodgers and all the teams that could spend all the money, they weren't focusing enough on developing their own talent because they had so much money. So for just a second, the financial discrepancy put a large hole into the top organizations and the fact that they weren't building enough talent in their farm system. But remember, both the Dodgers and Yankees did a reinvestment into their entire farm system in the middle of the 2010s. And since then, they now have two of the best 10 farm systems all the time. Why? Because they can spend money on it, not just money on coaches, but money on scouts, money on facilities, money on chefs. They can invest into their farm system at levels that mid-market and small-market teams can't. You see this in European soccer with Barcelona, with Real Madrid, with Manchester United. Specifically in Germany, Bayern Munich just won their 9th straight title. That didn't happen in the past, but it's happening now because of the financial discrepancies, and it's starting to take over the entire game. And so that's why I believe we're seeing so many more 100-game winners, because so many more franchises have to bottom out to rebuild their farm system to the level the Yankees and Dodgers are able to do it, while also spending $300 million on payroll.
It's true. No, it's 110% true. And I think that that's where it becomes interesting, because then the question becomes, how do small market teams catch up? Because now they're in a point where they just can't, right?
Yeah, either you have no payroll and you focus on just farm system, or you have to expend your entire farm system to make one run at.
Yeah, which a lot of teams have done. However, I still think this goes back to something that we've discussed lately, which is what the St. Louis Cardinals have done, what the Kansas City Royals have done in recent years. They've done a good job being middle market teams who've developed certain minor league talent, trading away certain minor league talent and holding on to, like, the problem is you have to time it perfectly. Like, it all has to work out. You can't have injuries. Like, look at how deep the Dodgers are. The Dodgers are hurt right now, and they still have the best run differential in baseball, right? Or one of the best.
Oh, yeah.
One of the best run differentials.
Well, just
baseball.
Think of there are a bunch of teams.
They're 18-17, but their run differential.
But there are a bunch of teams that if they suffered the type of injuries the Dodgers have suffered, they would have already collapsed into themselves. I mean, look at Minnesota. It's a perfect example with the Twins. I mean, this is a team that just was recently American League Central champions with a great farm system and what feels like an ascending culture of winning and all that good stuff. And they have a few injuries to start the season, a little bit of bad luck in one-run games, and it won't matter how good they are because they're already 7 back and they might end up being 10 back.
Yep.
So it just is too late sometimes in baseball when you have that many injuries and you don't have the depth to back it up because you don't have the money to spend on depth. I mean, that's really where the Dodgers and Yankees get their advantages. It is not from their frontline players. It is from their depth. It's the fact they get to spend money on guys that people would have in their three hole, and they're platooning in left field.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the type of depth that you really acquire. And again, some people might not know a thing about European soccer, But it's important to look at sports, not just here, but around the world, because it gives us more information, more data points to talk about. And the way the structure is set up in Major League Baseball, in terms of the financials of the team, is most similar to European soccer. Not the NBA, not the NFL. It's not, I really don't think it's that great to compare franchise building in the NBA and in the NFL with Major League Baseball.
This is why they're called ball clubs.
Yes.
They are clubs. They have development systems. They have academies. They have processes. It's also why you see people so interconnected with Major League Baseball teams, unlike they are with National Football League franchises. You have guys who go have a great career, the Peyton Mannings of the world, who go and they win a Super Bowl in Indianapolis. And everyone in Indianapolis loves Peyton Manning. But then he leaves. He goes to Denver. He wins a Super Bowl there. Everyone loves him there. Peyton's going to go. He's going to be maybe a front office executive in another organization down the road, like John Lynch. John Lynch, great example. Tampa Bay Buccaneer, Denver Bronco, and now he's the general manager of the 49ers, right? You don't have all the same connections in one academy, one franchise. You go look at David Bell, manager of the Reds, right? Tony La Russa, manager of the Chicago White Sox. Why is he the manager of the Chicago White Sox? Because there's this academy, there's this club, there's this alumni sense. Also, the weird thing about La Russa is that it's an owner trying to right a wrong from 30 years ago. But still, because there's a connection there, these guys stay with teams. It's like Mark Lewis with the Cincinnati Reds, right? He ended up leaving. He came back. And even baseball at the high school level. Like, Mark Lewis is a great player from Hamilton, Ohio. He lives in Hamilton, Ohio. He helps the local Hamilton baseball team. He helped them win a state title. It's like there's just these connections. Also, just for those of you who are joining us, if you're wondering why we're talking about 100-win seasons, why we're talking about organization building and all that, one of the questions that we're posing today is, can the Chicago White Sox win 100 games? And I don't think it's a question of can they, but I think it's more of a question of what has to happen, you know, and what will happen that leads to that. So what is it that would take the Chicago White Sox to win 100 games, Lucas? What is it that would have to change right now? Pitching's been great. Hitting's been solid.
I don't think
what would have to change?
I actually think the answer to that is nothing has to change. The status quo in terms of everybody else's performance, because this question is not about the White Sox. The White Sox have a lot of depth, and I know they've suffered a couple injuries, and sure, two or three more major injuries to bats in the lineup could change this equation, or injuries in the rotation. Obviously, always leave that on the table. But again, that's why I say the status quo right now for the White Sox, they look like they'll be the 100-win team in the American League. Because being a 100-win team is not just about the quality of team you have. It's also the quality of competition, because there's a real discrepancy in the schedules of baseball. And it's such a big season, it's 162 games, that whenever I mention this, the division you play in, I always get, oh, you got to play other teams, though. You got to play other teams. But think about this. You play the Tigers 18 times. That is a significant number. Compared to, you look at the Athletics, you say maybe the Athletics can win 100 games. Well, the Athletics, they've got to play the Angels, who are in last place in that division right now, with Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani in the lineup. Like, that's who they get to, quote-unquote, beat up on. So when you're looking at 100-game winners, do you really think the Red Sox are going to get there with the Yankees nipping on their heels all year? And that division is deep. Tampa Bay just made the World Series. They're in that division. Like, the American League has so much depth in the other divisions, other than the American League Central, which is currently falling apart. So the status quo maintains Cleveland is going to end up with the worst lineup in both leagues and the worst offense in both leagues. Getting no hit twice is not a coincidence. There's not a lot of guys that can hit there. And guaranteeing that Ramirez is going to be an MVP all year, I don't know if that's 100%.
Actually, I do have a fun fact to add to this. The last team, and it's going to kill me because I'm going to have to do a little research here in a moment as to who it was. But I was listening on air to Pat Hughes the other day doing the Cubs broadcast, and he had a lovely little tidbit. The last team to be no-hit twice was no-hit on back-to-back days. I believe it was the Detroit Tigers in 1961, and they either won or lost the World Series. So just a note, the argument might be that it's not an indication. You know, just throwing that out there. Last team to get no-hit twice in a regular season ended up winning the World Series, or at least got there. So I'm going to look up that fun fact here in a second. But one thing to
Indians
bounce...
Indians fans, if you're banking on that, I'm telling you, that's a bad idea.
Which is fair. I mean, it is fair.
I mean, this is... But it's a legitimately bad lineup. Now, the pitching staff is great, but it's three guys. Three guys with an ERA plus above 100, and 100 is league average. That's it. They're even thinner than the White Sox are in terms of their rotation arms. The White Sox have been dealing with Lucas Giolito pitching fairly average, and yet they're still the third best ERA in the American League.
Yeah, I still struggle to say that lineup is terrible. I mean, the Indians have Franmil Reyes. He's a stud. Ahmed Rosario, Eddie Rosario, get that. Jose Ramirez is absolutely an all-star. Cesar Hernandez has been a prospect for a long time who's come along. There are some major issues. Roberto Perez is not a normal everyday catcher. Jake Bowers has really struggled at first base. In fact, the Indians have had the worst stats at first base, which is a great indication. Most great baseball teams, right, you can throw a big bat at first base, especially in the American League. So I can agree with you there. Yu Chang is batting 140 with a 189 OBP and a 180 slugging percentage, and Jake Bowers is batting 204 with a 283 OBP and a 296 slugging. But still, there's some bats in that lineup, and their pitching is so good year in and year out that it's hard to count them out.
Okay, so best case scenario for the Indians with a lineup like that, I don't care if you say the names a little better. These guys are awful. They're having bad years.
Josh Naylor is pretty bad.
Naylor's pretty bad.
Him play baseball.
You know.
Thanks to the fact that we got to see him get no hit. That was helpful for that.
Yeah, that was a lot of
fun. I did want to pivot back to, you talked about teams and what their schedule allows them to do, because I think one of the best indicators of this, the Mariners, the 2001 Mariners, 116-46, without Ken Griffey Jr., right? This was not a Ken Griffey Jr. team anymore. That team's best player actually was Brett Boone, 37 home runs, 141 RBIs. But if you go look at that team, they did score 927 runs, 627 runs allowed. So their Pythagorean win-loss was 109 wins. It's not like there was some sort of crazy anomaly.
No.
They were a 100-win team. They were one of the greatest teams in baseball history. And sadly, they were one of the greatest offensive teams in Major League Baseball history. Their pitching was suspect, and that's exactly why they didn't win the World Series. In fact, that's why they didn't get to the World Series.
I mean, 900-some runs is a lot.
It's a lot of runs. But when you run into the New York Yankees in the playoffs, it doesn't really matter who is
hitting. But their division
was
bad. I mean, that's
but
the point.
So that's the point, is that the A's also won 102 games that year. The Angels were 75-87. The Rangers were 73-89. But remember, the AL West was a four-game division back then. So you got to play a lot more games against the AL East and the AL Central than you used to. And in the Central, the Tigers were 66-96. The Royals were 65-97. The White Sox were barely over 500. The Rays were 62-100, had barely been in baseball for very long. The Orioles were 63-98. The Blue Jays were 80-82. And the Red Sox were 82-79. The best team outside of the American League West was the Yankees, that won 95 games that year, which of course beat the Mariners in that playoff series. And then the next best team was the Indians at 91-71. No other team in the American League even won 90 games. And then you go look, because interleague play was still a thing then. And I always think this is interesting when you have 100-win seasons. Did anyone else really get close? No. The National League, 93 wins was the best record that year. Right? So there was a lot of really bad teams. The Reds lost the National League Central that year was horrifying. The Brewers lost 94. The Reds lost 96. The Pirates lost 100. Right? And so if you look at a team like that, they ran into a lot of the right teams. And if you look at the American League Central this year, I think it's absolutely that
formula. Because if we keep going through the teams, the Indians got no hit twice. The Minnesota Twins are literally, they essentially, imagine a battalion running onto the beach of Normandy. That's what's happened to the Twins lineup right now. They are half decimated. It's just not great in Minnesota right now.
But they certainly hit bombs.
It's a four-alarm fire in Minnesota. They're going to have to correct course very quickly, immediately, especially when we're talking about the 40-game rule, which we're running up to next week. When we do the podcast next week, we'll be at the 40-game mark, and we'll be able to do some of those breakdowns.
Well, I'm actually, one of the things I'm excited about today too is that we have a lot of teams who are already technically have a winning record before we've even reached the 40-game mark.
Yeah, all the 21 teams.
You know, there's teams who, you know, like the Boston Red Sox, who have been one of the more exciting surprises in baseball. And one of the reasons I think you and I like this Red Sox team, we were messaging about this the other day, is that they have been constructed.
Also, I like the White Sox.
They've been constructed in a unique way. They're different than what we've seen the winning formula be year in and year out in baseball. You know, it's not the new Moneyball, because Moneyball, we learned, you know, everybody learned it. So then everybody started valuing those things. They started valuing home runs. They started valuing walks. They started valuing on base percentage.
So then you ask, what's the weakness? What can we be better at than the rest of the league?
Not striking out is one of the number one things.
And there you go.
And the Red Sox don't strike out a lot. The White Sox lineup, one of the things they've done, it's less about their numbers this year. It's less about the actual number of strikeouts total, but it's actually more the number of games that they don't have high strikeout marks. But again, fifth least number of strikeouts in the American League. I mean, for the White Sox, they're putting the ball in play. And again, another one of the things the White Sox are doing that, you know, I know a lot of people don't like, but you and I are very much in on, is the fact that they have 14 sacrifice hits. It's first in the American League. They're moving runners over.
I'm neutral on it. I think
I like it. You're neutral.
Here's the thing about analytics. God, this conversation's happened 1,000 times in 1,000 places, 1,000,000 times in 1,000,000 places. But we really need to, these aren't just numbers. These are people, these are games, these are situations. And we have such a good grasp on the numbers of baseball that we've leaned into some things so hard that trends can reverse. That's the thing about Bill James, and that's the thing about the analytics guys, is they are analyzing baseball as it was to predict how it will be. And if you utilize these strategies, if everybody utilizes these strategies, the winning effectiveness of them is not going to be the same as the old analyzations of the way people used to play baseball. So the Athletics taking advantage of a hole is not the same thing anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because everybody is doing it. So you have to have your new Moneyball, your unique way of doing something. And I've talked about this before on shows. Uniqueness is the key to success in professional sports, because everybody is going to do the numbers right now. Everybody is going to have analytics. Everybody is going to be pushing artificial intelligence. The bottom line is all these organizations are going to have all the data in the world and all the sports. That won't be a problem. The data will tell you certain decisions. It's going to come down to that manalytics, that analyzing of the human being, of being a little different in certain ways. And that's why I really like the White Sox formula. You know, you can criticize Tony La Russa all you want. I just think we overanalyze the decisions of managers. And frankly, if you look at the statistics and analytics, if we're overanalyzing lineup construction and small decision-making late in games, if you look at the mathematical importance of that statistically, it's less than a run.
It really is.
It's less than half a run most of the time. It's less than a tenth of a run most of the time. But do you know what a guy with major league experience to the level that is, a guy that can influence a locker room, a guy that can make a guy who's having a bad day better, a guy who can communicate well and have people work better together and enjoy their time at work more and be a better team and be a better person, like development of the human being, what's that number? We've never calculated that. And I think that's why there are great managers. And the great managers nowadays, that's why I love what the Mets did with Luis Rojas. They didn't go out and find this super stat nerd. They're like, we have those guys. We need a guy that's able to communicate with these players on a different level. I really enjoy that approach. The Dusty Baker, Tony La Russa, hey, I'm here for the ball players to make them better. And, you know, you can nitpick my decisions, but they're frankly not worth enough for us to sit here and argue about.
Yeah, no, and that's one of the things that makes baseball great, right, is the personalities, the meshing of those personalities. And the stories, right, the Jose Abreus, the Yermin Mercedes. And that's another thing about Tony La Russa that I love, is that who wouldn't love to play for a guy who has managed some of the greatest players of the past generation? Right, especially Albert Pujols won a World Series with those St. Louis Cardinals teams. Edmonds was on those teams. Scotty Rowland. Those are guys who everyone, and also think about those three guys: Albert Pujols, Jim Edmonds, Scotty Rowland. Right, three guys that almost everyone would think, "Wow, would love to be a teammate. would love to be a teammate with these people. Yadier Molina, same thing. As much as people around the National League Central and even around baseball dislike Molina, everyone would love for him to be on their team, right? And so La Russa has experience managing those guys. And then you look at the Dusty Bakers of the world. Where did Dusty Baker really get his launch managing? He got to manage Barry Bonds in San Francisco. I want to play for that guy. And then he came to Chicago, and he got to manage some really great ball teams here. Derek Lees, Aramis Ramirez, right? Michael Barrett, right? Guys who are all smart baseball guys. Alfonso Soriano, right? Those are fun, interesting ball teams. Moises Alou was on these teams. And what's similar to all these guys' names is that even some of the ones who...
Well, Sammy Sosa.
Sammy Sosa, obviously can't leave him off the list. I don't think that people would call him a great team player, though. I mean,
but
a great ball player, obviously.
I'd love to have him on my team.
Absolutely. And why has Dusty Baker gotten the opportunity to manage and win with Barry Bonds, Sammy Sosa, Joey Votto, Jose Altuve? You can throw a couple of names on the list with the Astros right now. There's a couple really good guys, you know, good guys in that team. But Altuve will be a Hall of Famer. And it's because players love playing for him.
Yeah, and you know what? This is a cross-sport.
And Nationals.
Yeah.
So Harper was on that team when he managed that team
Yeah, because, like, here's the thing, people. Max and I could sit there, go sit in the dugout and make the exact decisions these guys make, and would probably do them with about the same level of competency in terms of pitching changes, double switches, deciding when to steal, deciding when to bunt, all that stuff. If you play MLB The Show, people, you can do that job.
Or if you've coached Little League.
It's really, that's not what you pay a manager to do. It's the conversations. It's the development. It's the people.
Here's the experience I have in this field and why you should listen to me. Here are the interesting stories. Here's the team that we put together, and this is why I think this team is as special as that one, right?
Yeah, and chemistry and those things that numbers cannot track, will never be able to track. That's what really matters.
So I think the question that we're posing then, if we're talking about teams that could win 100 games, such as the White Sox, what is the feeling in that locker room? Is it a
They're
feeling?
Loose.
Is there something special about it? I think it feels very special.
Well, I felt, you know, I had a criticism when one of the games I went, pretty sure it was Robert in center field. He just looked too loose. Like, they weren't ready to play in the first inning. And we remember the morning game against the Red Sox. Oh my gosh,
that was terrible.
I don't know what type of tequila they were drinking at 3 a.m., but man, they came out slow. But listen, it's a 162-game season. After they've taken a lot of time off and only had a 60-game season.
Yep.
So this will be the longest season any of these guys have ever played in their lives.
It'll definitely feel that way.
And that's why I had this, like, criticism. Oh, they're playing too loose. But it's April. It's May. And La Russa has been talking about that. Hey, this team's good enough. We need to be loose. We need these guys to have mental longevity to be playing in August. That's why sometimes you're going to lose a game because you didn't do the perfect lineup construction, or you left some guys out, or you're a little loose. But La Russa knows this is a march, and that's where experience really comes in, and that patience and I enjoy that they're a little more kicked back, because they're good enough that they don't need to be locked into April or it's going to go off the rails. They need to have longevity to be good in July and August.
And I think the Dodgers are the greatest example of that over the last few years. No one has ever stressed about the Dodgers. The Dodgers right now, if they were probably almost any other team in baseball, let's say they're the Yankees. Yankees have this hot start. Everyone's like, oh man, you know, great start to the year. And then if the Yankees have a series like the Dodgers had against the Padres.
Oh my God.
If the Yankees did that against the Red Sox, right? Everyone's going to be like, oh, whoa.
And they'll get railed.
And then all of a sudden, you know, an equivalent maybe in the American League East right now is the Blue Jays, not the Orioles, but maybe the Blue Jays. And then all of a sudden you get swept by the Blue Jays, similar to how the Dodgers, lost a series to the Reds. Same thing. All of a sudden now it's like, wait, they had an off series against the Red Sox, and then they had an off series against the Blue Jays. But with the Dodgers, they had an off series against the Padres. They had an off series against the Reds. They're 18-17. They're loose. We've seen them do their damage. And that is where La Russa's got this right, because all you need to be is, when you know you're good enough, you just got to make sure you're staying above 500, right? You don't want to be chasing, right? Nobody wants to chase.
No.
But Because we did see a team who figured it out but was never loose until literally the final pitch when they won the World Series, the Nationals, right? They started 18-32, and I mean, that team was on the edge of their seat all year long. Like, my goodness, that was brutal. Like, it was just agonizing. It was not a march. It was a balancing act.
Well, when you couldn't get Bryce Harper back, I mean, it became this big fan avalanche, and that's the thing is that—
But then they did it. They did it. But it was like, you don't want to win that way. I mean, it doesn't matter how you win. You'll take a World Series no matter how you can get it. But still, it's better to get it loose, and that's how you avoid going 18-32. That's how you stay around 500, and then you get hot. You get those runs late in the year where everything is clicking all at the same time. Because it's one thing the White Sox haven't had a ton of. You know, the no-hitter we went to—
But they certainly have. Listen, the White Sox have all the recipes. Nick Madrigal is one of those guys that he's just like, oh, that guy's going to bat ninth for you every once in a while? Like, he's one of the most exciting prospects ever because of his ability to not miss the ball.
Yes.
There was a point earlier this year, I don't know what the stat is now, where he'd only missed five times, swung and missed five times in Major League Baseball, in modern Major League Baseball. And that's the thing is there's so many guys, the manager kind of reversed in time. Some of the players are reversing in time in terms of their play style, a little more contact, less home runs, right? The decisions, some sacrifice bunting, it's reversing in time. And everybody's like, oh my gosh, it's the wrong decision. But when it's when you're the only team doing that, when you're the only team trying to edge out games, when you're the only team that's having a different approach at the plate, or one of the only teams doing it, and you pair that with a lot of natural talent and a deep pitching staff and a deep bullpen, that's how you get the recipe for a lot of wins, especially in the division they're in. Now, am I worried about the White Sox in the playoffs against, say, a Yankees? Yes.
Oh, of course.
I'm not sure they're a World Series winning team. That's a completely different question than can this team win 100 games? And the formula for the White Sox winning the 100 games is clear. Simply add a piece at the deadline. If you have some of your starters develop in the back end, maybe not even a starter. Maybe you're adding another bullpen arm as another stalwart back there. But add something at the deadline. Keep hitting the way you're hitting. You don't really have to change much. And watch the division implode the way it's been imploding.
Yeah, absolutely. His whiff rate, by the way, is still 4.8%.
Oof.
That's it. It's first in Major League Baseball. And he's only gotten 111 plate appearances, which is still, that's about a starter. I mean, that is. That's a starter in baseball. But still, so he has swung and missed literally only 5% of the time. Here's my actually favorite stat, is that he's chasing 26% of the time. So that means when you're swinging at a ball outside of the strike zone. In the majors, the rate of chase is about 28%, which is, that's not bad. Chase contact in the majors, 58%. He makes contact outside of the zone 85% of the time.
Oh, wow.
When he swings. And that's how you get on base. I mean, that's honestly, Altuve for a minute, you know, would talk in interviews and he lost it. I don't know if he started getting focused on power, but I remember when Altuve started doing more English interviews down in Houston, he's this very interesting character, right? You know, the story behind Altuve is that he got told, you know, to go away. He came back. They gave him $15,000. Well, first, go away, come back. Go away, come back. Go away, come back. But his whole goal was to be the next Pete Rose for a minute there. He was all about 200 hits for the next 20 years. And then he started hitting home runs, and I think he got, you know, maybe more on base percentage. People started pitching him more carefully. But the reason that he has had 200 hits three times is because he'll swing at anything, and he makes contact at anything. And Madrigal's doing that. And
well, a good pitch to hit is not always a pitch in the zone.
Absolutely.
And I think
not.
Any great hitters know that. And it depends on the situation.
And it depends on the hitter. It depends on the situation.
And the type of pitcher you're facing.
You know, I watched a walk-off earlier this season, Nicholas Castellanos with the Reds. Everyone knows his spot is low and away. That is where you pitch him. You do not want to, you don't pitch him anywhere else, really, in the zone. You're willing to pitch to the low outside corner. He's a right-handed hitter, so you're pitching into that almost into a slider or a changeup that's either going to break towards the left-handed batter's box or it's going to barely catch the zone. He knew that in that situation. There were runners on second and third. He's a pull hitter. They had a five-man infield, four guys on the left side. You know what he did? He was looking for the low and away pitch. They gave him the low and away pitch, and he poked it into center field for a base hit. That's what great hitters do. And I think baseball's starting to have a few more. I hope so. I mean, there's certainly a lot of guys who can hit the ball a hell of a lot harder than, you know, we've ever seen.
There's more mashers than hitters.
Yeah.
Which, I mean.
Yeah, like Jock Peterson, masher, not a hitter.
There's just a lot of mashers and not a lot of hitters.
But Abreu is a hitter. Jose Abreu, when he's at his best, he's a hitter.
This White Sox lineup, no, this White Sox lineup is full of guys that know how to hit. Yeah. That's what I love. Is Nick Madrigal on the back end of your lineup knows how to hit already. I mean, the numbers you just read and watching his plate appearances. This guy, he might not be a great hitter right now, but he knows how to hit at a really special level. And the difference between being a great hitter and knowing how to hit is a skill that you acquire at like 17, 18. You just have this way of controlling an at-bat. Now, being able to execute it is a whole other thing. And that's the difference between good baseball players who flame out and great baseball players who make it to Major League Baseball, right? I just love that this White Sox, in an era where they're getting so many mashers, I mean, much respect to Javi Baez, but does Javi Baez know how to hit, or is he a great hitter? Like, when it comes in, this guy's going to mash it. And you're going to have to throw it in sometimes because he won't swing at everything, although he'll swing at mostly everything. But, like, and look at Eugenio Suarez in Cincinnati.
Oh,
that is, oh my gosh, he's leading the league in swing and misses. I mean, that's just unacceptable. It's like his chase percentage, it's just a disaster. He doesn't know how to hit. One year they didn't know how to pitch to him, so he hit 50-something home runs. But he doesn't know how to hit. He's a hitter.
Well,
and there's a difference. There's a longevity to it. That's what separates, to me, the greatest of great hitters and guys who know how to hit. There's just a different approach to it. Like Derek Jeter knew how to hit. A-Rod, much better hitter. But boy, when you watch A-Rod in the playoffs sometimes, felt like this guy was all talent sometimes. Is he really taking an approach? Does he have a control of the at-bat? And I just feel like up, down, 1-9, the White Sox are full of those guys that know how to hit and are great guys in terms of their approach and the way they understand how to play baseball at the plate.
Yeah, and then I'm looking at Madrigal's spray chart. I want you to take a peek at this. We'll have to post this on our website because it's really fun. One of the things I think is most interesting, now these spray charts on Baseball Savant, by the way, just because it looks like a ball is in the infield, that doesn't mean it's in the infield. That's where the ball kind of lands or
bounces on a line drive.
And it's also about a number of feet. So in some ballparks, you know, bigger infield, smaller infield, but the way that they do the dirt and all those different things. But what I like about him is that there's a lot of hits that genuinely are in the infield. I would say of these that I'm looking at, there's 8 hits that are probably definitely infieldish hits, you know, and I'm sure some of those are even making it out to the outfield, but just where they're being hit is impressive. But on his spray chart, what I love is that while he is a pull hitter when it comes to hitting some singles to the left side of the field, he really does spray the ball to the right side very well too. And when they've shifted him at times, he's done a great job of slapping the ball through the hole on the right side, and it's making him hard to shift. Again, he doesn't have a home run. He's got 10 RBIs. He's got one stolen base. But
I don't care about the home run.
But if there's one thing that is true about the 9-hole hitter in the modern lineup, in the old lineups, in any lineup, you want another leadoff hitter there. He's a leadoff hitter. You can bat him at 1. You can bat him at 2. And the fact that they have the flexibility to bat him at 9, if that's not an indication of depth, especially when everything hasn't been healthy completely yet, right? Not completely healthy. That's a pretty good indication.
You know, there's so many in baseball, especially because it's 162 games, not being completely healthy sometimes when you have a lot of guys that are coming up, like the White Sox have.
It's a good thing.
It can be a good thing because you get those guys to develop at a level they wouldn't have developed otherwise. And that's really exciting. For me, the White Sox winning 100 games, it's starting to look like it. In terms of goals for the team, I think the way the early season portion is played out, we're close enough to 40 games that I think you and I can say that for the Chicago White Sox, the goal is not the American League Central. That's the expectation.
Yes.
The goal is to have the best record in the American League, which I think will require 101 wins over like a 98 win Red Sox or 99 win Yankees. So the goal for the White Sox is to have home field advantage throughout the playoffs. That's the goal.
Absolutely.
And that's the, and with the Dodgers
down. And the goal is to win the pennant. I mean, that's the goal.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, but listen, in baseball, if you're talking about postseason goals in the regular season, you're way, way, way off the mark, right?
Yeah.
The postseason in baseball is such a crapshoot. Listen, the Dodgers were the best team significantly in baseball for about 4 years. They won one World Series. It's a crapshoot. It's not the NBA. In the NBA, over seven games with those type of matchups, best team wins 99.9% of the time. Now, you might not always know who the best team is, but the best team wins in the NBA. In baseball, it's just not the same. And we all know that. That's why you play 162, and that's why determining a champion of who the best team is in 18 games after you played 162, because there's so much variance, that's why I always call it a crapshoot. And as an organization, you have to decouple playoffs from the regular season. And you have to build your organization to be successful in the regular season first, and then find what your weaknesses are in the postseason and stack those up when you can. And if you're, that's not your organizational approach, you'll never win a World Series. And I think the Yankees found that out for a few years. Really, they found that out over the last decade.
They have, absolutely.
And I think the Dodgers found that out as well, because when both of them recommitted to having depth for a 162-game season, being able to switch guys in and out, they became much better ball clubs, won more consistently, had deeper teams, and made better postseason runs because of it.
I still think one of the things that's true in baseball, and I think it's true in developing soccer programs too, you know, because that's been the comparison, right, is these clubs. I still think that when you have to focus in a certain area, that there's always going to be something that organizations are missing, even the greatest, right, that they just can't focus all their energy on. And that is the question that is being posed. And I know the question gets harder every year, right, for small market and middle market teams. What is the area that the big market teams are missing on, right? But I think that the difference now is that where big market teams are focusing in on, it creates, I think the Pirates tried to do something like the Reds did, and this is where it starts to get unique. You build a good minor league system, you put together a solid team, and your hope is, as a small market or middle market team, to be a 500-level team, and then you have to trade for player control. And that's the thing in baseball that's becoming very interesting that the White Sox could do this year, right? Is do a similar move that the Reds did with Sonny Gray or Trevor Bauer, something that...
stop getting rentals.
Yep, it's not short-term rentals, but instead it's 2 years. Or it's someone, yes, you're trading for them at this deadline with the intention of, okay, we want you here this year, but we still have arbitration control on you for one more year. Or we're going to extend you as soon as you get in this building and make you a difference maker on this team for a couple of seasons. And that's something that started to become, and again, they're still rentals. It's mostly short-term deals, right? But I think that's the move the White Sox have the potential to make this year. And the question becomes, who is that guy? Is it a Carlos Correa, right? Do you shock everyone and pull in this massive bat?
I think it's an arm.
Which, that's great too. And maybe that arm is a Zach Greinke or, and I don't know why I'm sticking with the Astros, but you know, whatever. How about the Indians? Indians end up getting out of it, and the Indians have proven that they do not care. They'll trade with anyone. They don't care if they're an interdivision rival. As long as they're not in it anymore, they'll trade with you. And if the Indians are out, you go get a Bieber or a Savali, you know. There's a lot of options out there for the White Sox.
I think that it's going to be a top line move. Because here's the thing. Jerry Reinsdorf likes championships. He won 7 in 15 years, okay? 7 in 15 years. Jerry Reinsdorf is really pissed off that he doesn't get credit for breaking the Chicago baseball championship curse. That was overlooked completely because everybody wanted the Cubs to win it first.
That's a really good point.
Everybody wanted the Cubs to win it first. So now Jerry Reinsdorf is watching this Cubs team absolutely botch what feels like the greatest team they've had since Tinker Evers and Chance back in the early 1900s.
Also, he's 85.
And he's getting
older.
He
knows his window's closing.
He hasn't won a championship in any sport in 15 years.
Yeah.
And he knows that in that an event like what we just went through is radically can change the world. And this, he knows this is his last opportunity to maybe make the White Sox the prominent team. I don't think it'll ever happen.
But I do think the narrative changes. If this White Sox team
spends money, goes out, let's say they go out and get who could be the best pitcher in your mind that is potentially available on the market. That's even if it's a 1-year rental.
Zach Greinke is a really, I think that's one of the ones who is very possible to be available. Things have to go right there. The Astros have to feel out or feel the need for some prospects. So here's the reason I say that. Astros are also in a Cubs-type situation. Everyone knows they can't re-sign everyone this offseason, so they need to reload. So even they could still even be in it and feel the need to move a starting pitcher because they have enough depth at starting pitcher. So they could move a Greinke for some prospects, right? I think that's the number one.
Man, there's going to be an elite guy we're not even thinking of that's just available.
And I know I'm going to go look at a couple
a
rotations.
Literal front line. I mean, because that's what you do. And so what? It doesn't add to the top, even if it's a great rotation. Because if Rodon stays healthy and, you know, Cease keeps pitching the way he's pitching and there's depth and all the starters are on for the White Sox, do you really need another arm? No. But for the playoffs, you do. And if you can go add a frontline guy, I think you do it in a heartbeat. And I think that's their intention. They want to look like, organizationally, hey, we spend money. We're the team that is the third largest city in the United States.
We're the team that's going for it.
We're going to go for it. And we're going to go for it really hard. I think that seems to be in the air. And I think that you can look at another team that Reinsdorf owns in the city, the Chicago Bulls. They just made what many thought, and I think, was a premature trade, a go-for-it trade to try to pair a now all-star Zach LaVine with an all-star in Nikola Vucevic. It's starting to look a little better now, but it was a big risk and a big swing to try to win this year. And if not this year, you carry two all-stars and get to flip the other 10 players on the roster and try to make a run at this thing. That's the aggressiveness you're feeling from the other team that Reinsdorf owns. So I think you're definitely going to see it with the White Sox. Without a doubt, you're going to see it with the White Sox, that aggressiveness come July, because this team is going to be out in front in first place. They're going to, hey, maybe we go six-man rotation, get these guys some length, have them only because you're being really conservative with it. I think they're going to take a big, big swing at the deadline.
We'll have to take a mental note in our next podcast when we talk about the 40-game rule, when we're talking about baseball. We should really look into, because I've pulled up a couple of names that I'd like to break down a little more in depth. If the White Sox want to add an arm, who's going to be available come deadline? I think that would be a fun one to do a little bit of info on.
Yeah, I think we should do a 40-game. The next podcast is, we might do one in between, but the next one when we hit the 40-game mark, mostly through baseball, is we're going to do a 40-game rule breakdown, 2, Cubs and White Sox trade outlook, because they're on two different sides of the coin.
Yep.
And
they might not be, but they are.
They're on two different sides of the coin. The Cubs have already told us what they want to do.
Yeah.
So.
And then another part of that 40-game mark, which this is what makes the 40-game mark interesting, and we'll get to it in that podcast. This is just a little tease. For someone like the White Sox, when your division is all hovering around 500, your chances at 40 games when you're well over 500, even better. Red Sox right now, they're 22-14, but the AL East is tight, right? So their chances might be a little lower. So we'll also see, of those teams who have a winning record at 40 games, who feels like a lock and who feels like a not.
Yeah, we're going to be able to cross some teams off, I think, as well. I mean, I could already cross some teams off for you.
Pirates.
Tigers. I mean, we could cross those off before the season, though.
That's true. New teams you could probably cross off. Royals have been fun. I think you'll end up crossing them off.
Yeah, I love the Marlins run differential, but if you can't get a winning record with that type of run differential early in the year, that run differential is not going to hold for them, and I think that they already blew their opportunity to be a team that's in the mix.
Rangers off. Mariners off.
Yeah. The poor Angels, because it's just not going to happen. Mike Trout.
So bad for baseball.
Mike Trout must have made a damn deal with the devil to be as good at baseball as he is. He said, you know what?
Hall of Famer, one of the greats.
Devil comes by and Mike Trout goes, I want to be a Hall of Famer. I want to be one of the greats. And the devil says, I can give you that ability, but you'll never play in the playoffs significantly. And he goes, deal. That's a lot of money. I'd take that deal too, Mike Trout.
We didn't even touch Albert Pujols' commentary today. We'll have to talk about that next time too.
Oh, and Aaron Rodgers is really news in this region. I think Miami's the dark horse.
We might have to do a show tomorrow. Might have to add one more.
Might have to. All right, this has been On the Shore. We went long today. Hope you enjoyed it. Check out our new website, ontheshorepod.com. Just a lot of info about the hosts and past episodes and such. So ontheshorepod.com. Please check that out.